Writer Thomas Glave was born in the Bronx 35 years ago to Jamaican parents. He now splits his time between New York City and the Caribbean and maintains dual citizenship. His work has appeared in the Best Short Stories by Black Writers 1967 to the present and Gave Fiction at the Millennium. Glave did a Fulbright Fellowship in Jamaica and has received two fellowships from the Bronx Council on the Arts and an NEA Travel Grant Fund for artists. He received the 1997 O. Henry Award and last year was named one of the Village Voices Writers on the Verge. A collection of his works called Whose Song and Other Stories is in bookstores now, and Thomas Glave joins us from our Chicago bureau. Welcome, Thomas.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
You know, I read about the influences. You've been exposed to a lot of different cultural influences, and certainly that enriches your work. But I was wondering, when you actually sit down to write, is that helpful or is it confusing?
I think that it would, of course, have to be helpful because of the great variety, the kind of repository that you have, right, of different voices, different approaches to language, different familiarities with language, different sorts of sensibilities, all these sorts of things. And I think that ultimately, when the work is being done, those things, of course, infuse the bloodstream, right? They're actually in your metabolism, so to speak. So that I would find them, although I might not be aware of them necessarily at the time, their presence brings a richness and a variety and a diversity of all sorts of exposures.
Well, certainly,
to enhance the
yeah,
work.
And one of the things that really characterizes your work is the vivid dialogue. I mean, you sort of have that down, and you talked about that. You talked about growing up in an environment, especially in a Caribbean culture, where there's a lot of levels of conversation going on all at the same time.
Oh, yes, definitely. And, you know, language is very electrical and dynamic, and so there's a lot of wordplay all the time and pun-making and all kinds of things, which, of course, we also see in African-American language, so that the interplay between people and the interplay between cultures, in this case, I suppose, North and South, I would say, is extremely powerful and brings a kind of electricity to one's imagination.
Let's take an example from some of your work. I was thinking about maybe The Final Inning. And again, so much of your work is about identity and having to conceal identity and try to, for your characters to find out who they are. And in many cases, not be able to express themselves completely and how other people see them. And this story certainly gets at someone's identity. This is even after they're dead. They're not allowed to have control of their identity. Go ahead and set this up for us.
Sure. Well, in The Final Inning, in this section that I'll read, this concerns the conversation between one of the characters who is still alive, Gregory, who is married to Jackie in the story, and Duane, who has passed on, presumably of AIDS, and who was also gay, self-identified as gay in this black community in the fictional neighborhood Sound Hill in the Bronx. And so here we hear Gregory's voice thinking, talking to Duane and about Duane as he wrestles, Gregory, that is, with some aspects of his own identity, some of which are hidden, some of which are more ostensible. Yes, Gregory thought, the God's honest truth. Duane had told Nikki, but why? Did you have to tell her or anybody up here, Duane? Why? Couldn't you keep it downtown with all them downtown faggots that came up to the funeral? Why? But it had to, Duane had said. They were all his family and friends, weren't they? Had always loved him, they said. Would always care for him, they said. Wouldn't they? Hadn't become like whiteys who dissed their own at the drop of a hat, had they? Ooh, but they didn't want nobody to know you had it, Duane. When they heard you had it, said, yup, serves his ass right, because you know he got it from hanging out with them nasty old white boys, village faggots, downtown too much, and that's why you was funny, they said.
Thomas Glave reading from his book Whose Song and Other Stories, this one called The Final Inning. Name-calling is a very important part of all this. It really runs throughout your book, and as I say, your stories vividly portray this kind of street talk, trash-talking. But it really has a way of injuring identities and informing the speaker as well as the character.
Yes, I think that that's true, and I think also that at the same time that these words are used, these epithets and so on, you know, there's a tension, I think, between the words spoken, certainly in that story and in some of the others, the words, the insults that are hurled, that is actually a kind of overlay to the kind of tortured, anguished interior life of some of the characters who feel, for example, that they cannot give voice to who they are fully, right? So that if you have an exterior dialogue in which you have all kinds of homophobic, let us say, language, but you have a character at the same time experiencing the sort of venom of that homophobia, but not being able to talk about that, there is, of course, going to be a tension between what is spoken and what is not.
And your characters don't always seem to know that they're the victims of this, that a part of the agony they feel is their inability to express who they are.
Yes, indeed. Well, I think that there's so many complications, you know, in the kinds of adherences that people feel they must put forth to certain notions of masculinity, to certain notions of blackness, to certain notions of nationhood and identity in that regard, to class, to all these gender conformities and stereotypes, you know, so that when people do not have a language that is really clear and, let us say, honest, really forthcoming, I think, of course, all kinds of complications come up.
So, in a sense, these characters, you know, have to sort of pretend to the dominant culture around them, but there's also a certain pretense within the subculture as well.
Oh, I think that, yes, indeed. I mean, I think that on the one hand, there are different kinds of consciousness. I mean, we talk about this, right, in history and other disciplines about double consciousness when we speak about, as W.E.B. Du Bois did, when we talk about different ways of living and conceiving and perceiving identity and reality, because one might live as a so-called minority culture within a dominant culture. Yeah. But then also, if you think of someone, say, for example, who is African American living in the U.S., but then who is also gay living within an African-American community, there is, I would say, or lesbian, for that matter, there's a triple or quadruple consciousness, right, because of all the increased insiderness, but also outsiderness simultaneously, which one occupies.
But there are also problems for the dominant culture in perceiving who they are. I mean, I think about your story, And Love Them, and Love Them, you know, about the woman who says, I'm not a racist, but... And that sort of 10,000-pound gorilla of a butt that follows, I'm not a racist. But that's a tortured consciousness as well.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that she's somebody who's an example of someone who does not have an articulate language to really express the complexity and the ambiguity and the ambivalence of her emotions, you see. So that we see her, I think, in this back and forth colloquy with herself about them, as she calls them, black people, right? And the very word them for her is an example of her inarticulation, because she cannot find a way, I think, to really express honestly what she feels in a way that might be more insightful to her.
Read us something from And Love Them.
Sure, yes. This is just from And Love Them, written in the first-person voice of a white woman who is not named, talking, just expressing here some of her feelings about them. I can't be held accountable for what society does to people, and I shouldn't have to suffer for it. I wasn't around 100 years ago, and I've never stolen anything from one of them. Never. But you can see it in their eyes, how they try to put it all on you. And when I think of that, I just want to scream, or break something, or kill any of them. Because just ask yourself, how can they keep on blaming everybody for things that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago? I've never even been in Georgia or any of those places. And after all the bad things that have happened, well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a good person. I have a life I can call my own, and a job.
Thomas, do you write for a particular audience?
I don't think so, no. I think I really write the stories that I really want to read.
When you get feedback, do you know if your work, for instance, is well-received among those outside of the gay community?
That's really interesting, you know, because just with this book, and also when some of the stories were published in journals and anthologies before the book was published, it was really fascinating to me, and still is fascinating, to hear how so many different people read, for example, the same story, right? Hmm. So very differently, depending on, of course, their own individuality, but also perhaps on their sexuality or their race or their class. You know, all these, once again, right, difference comes in as a factor. So it's really fascinating when you have just, you know, a block of text that is a story, yeah? Mm-hmm. And to see that this is what it is on the page, right, and yet it is perceived so differently.
Thomas Glave is the author of Whose Song and Other Stories, a collection of short stories published by City Lights Books in San Francisco. And he joins us from our Chicago bureau. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Frank.